History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. On June 29, 1919, one day after the Treaty of Versailles brought about the end of World War I, nearly 70 cyclists embarked on the 13th Tour de France. From Paris, the war-weary men rode down the western coast on a race that would trace the country's border through seaside towns and mountains to the ghostly Western Front, traversing a cratered post-war landscape that looked like the surface of the moon after an asteroid strike, where there were pockmarked craters and really no vegetation or life to be found. The cyclists faced near impossible odds and the psychological scars of war. Most of the athletes had arrived straight from the front, where so many fellow countrymen had suffered or died. 67 cyclists, some of whom were still on active military duty, started out from Paris, and only 11 finished the month-long tour. The cyclists' perseverance and tolerance for pain would be tested in a grueling competition. To discuss the story of human endurance is Aidan Dobkin, author of Sprinting Through No Man's Land. He explains how the cyclists united a country that had been torn apart by unprecedented desolation and tragedy, and how devastated countrymen and women can come together to celebrate the adventure of a lifetime and discover renewed fortitude, purpose, and national identity. Dobkin profiles competitors, including Frenchman Eugene Christophe, whose commitment to finishing the race after he lost the lead while stopping to repair his bike's broken frame captured the country's imagination, and vividly describes the arduous ascents, rubble-strewn streets, and the crowds that line the route waving flags and shouting encouragement. So we talk about a lot of things in this episode, including how incredible it is that people could do the Tour de France when you had a very heavy bicycle. You had to actually take off a tire to change gears. If a frame bent, a blacksmith would have to replace it. And you know, nothing like the support crews that modern-day Tour de France teams have. And we also look at how the events of this Tour de France actually relate to 2021 and post-COVID lockdown life, where we're trying to get on with our lives after a really terrible event happened, but how some things can't be retrieved and how you have to rebuild and move forward. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Aidan Dobkin. Aidan, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, your book topic is very interesting for a number of reasons, which we'll get into. One of which is that I've spent considerable time on this podcast looking at World War I, the battles in particular, and how World War I changed the entire global order. If we're talking about European power, if we're talking about society and culture, government systems, really anything you could imagine. But I think you're the first interview that looks at a topic right after the end of hostilities in World War I. And when I think about what Europe looks like, I imagine after an asteroid strike where there's craters everywhere and it seems like all vegetation and life is burned off. But to set the stage for your book, what was the mood of the world in 1919 after armistice, after the Treaty of Versailles? How would you describe in general the mood in Europe and France in particular?
Yeah, so the understanding that I have of this kind of general popular sentiment is there is at first, understandably, this, you know, boisterous exuberance toward, you know, simply being done with the thing, you know, an absolutely devastating war that affected, you know, every single individual, certainly within France and in many other surrounding countries. And so there is this natural outpouring of exuberance at the immediate announcement of armistice. And then a kind of recognition of so many aspects of society being the word I always use during this, you know, 6 to 12 months after the end of, or at the, after the signing of armistice is kind of this molten period where there is both a recognition that there is an opportunity and a necessity for something different, but also not a clear direction in what that new way forward is really going to look like. And a lot of competition that will, in the end, last until the next war, that the war that was never supposed to happen, and partially as a result of kind of this, these lingering questions over what society should look like after the end of World War I. So it's a balance of exuberance, particularly in the immediate aftermath, and then this questioning over what every aspect of society really should look like. Yeah.
Well, one of the questions I imagine is those who want to resume activities that happened before the war, but it's a question of, Can you pick up where you left off, or are things so irrevocably changed that it's impossible? So one of those efforts is the Tour de France. So can you tell me about the founder's desire to restart it, and what are issues he has to contend with when he's doing it immediately after the end of the Great War?
Right. So the founder of Lotto, Henri de Grange, was a sports daily newspaper editor who didn't found the Tour de France, but took credit for its founding and continued the management of it starting in 1903. And something to recognize, given this immediate subject of the 1919 tour, is that the Tour of the Past really had so many political undertones to it, given the nature of the race back then, which is a race that literally traced France's borders and in many ways gave a whole host of French people who didn't have a complete understanding of their country's geography a better understanding of that geography, given the fact that this tour traced the borders of the country. And so at the end of World War I, Henri, who had always had not political aspirations so much as an understanding of the interplay between sports and politics, decided to himself that for reasons that are varied, including certainly grandiose ones relating to the rebuilding of a country, but also personal ambition, that the race simply had to occur as soon as possible. And in this case, that meant just 7 months after armistice was signed. It literally started on June 29th, 1919, which was the same day as the signing of the Treaty of Versailles. And this desire and almost compulsion to start the race as soon as possible after the end of the war shaped how that race was conducted, as well as the numerous difficulties that the cyclists wound up encountering on the road. This wound up being the second longest tour in history at 5,500 kilometers, or about 3,500 miles, wound up by nature of being a race that literally traced the border of the country, wound up riding through the Western Front. Even when they weren't riding through the Western Front, they were encountering roads that were in disrepair. And it all stems from this understanding on Henri's part that sports was a necessity for a country's, or at least in his opinion, you know, a necessity for a country's strength. And, you know, something that runs throughout the book is this feeling of needing to rebuild, of needing to move past. And I think that has political undertones to it as well, this desire to move past versus a full reckoning of what had just occurred. But this personal ambition and this desire to move forward and this desire to be unbroken, the 1919 tour was as intense, if not more intense, and as complete, if not more complete, than any race to that point. And that was a direct function of how this newspaper editor, Henri de Grange, thought about sports and thought about the tour and thought about his lasting legacy as someone who would wind up becoming known as the father of the Tour de France.
Well, I can see why you would devote a book to this topic, because there's a convergence of two things that make this a really challenging event. Number one, the way that World War I affected the topography of France. After over a century after the end of hostilities, there's still unexploded munitions throughout the countryside. It's been permanently altered. When a co-host and I were going through the main battles, we kept noting with the Battle of Verdun, it's 299 days long. This is almost, I mean, multiple times longer than the Battle of Gettysburg, 100 times longer, 50 times longer than the entire Six-Day War between Israel and Arab states. There are millions of pounds of munitions in the air at any one given time. World War I is marked by tremendous, horrifying artillery barrages, followed by hundreds of thousands of men that are killed. And this is just a few months after that, or a short year. So on the one hand, you have one of the most hellish wars the globe has ever seen. On the other hand, you have a physical activity that is pushing a human to the outer limits of anaerobic possibility. With the exception of maybe something like competitive rowing, there are few sports that really push someone to the absolute limits of endurance. So I don't condone performance-enhancing drugs in sports, but I can at least understand the rationale in competitive cycling. So what would it be like to stage the Tour de France? What did it look like to stage this in a post-war hellscape?
Yeah, so one should keep in mind before even getting to the immediate conditions on the ground that the tour of up through the 1930s was a race that the closest equivalent we have to modern sensibilities would be the ultra marathon. It goes beyond that in some ways, but nowadays tour will be starting on June 26th. I don't know when this will be launched, but it will probably be immediately surrounding the start of the tour. The tour will be ongoing. These days, the tour is generally 20-something stages. The average stage is between 20 or so kilometers for time trials and 150 kilometers or so for standard flat sections of the race. The shortest distances in the 1919 tour were 350 kilometers or so, oftentimes including alpine sections. And so so the average day of a tour stage would start at 2 or 3 in the morning with the cyclist setting off from the town that they had spent just one night recovering, and then hit the road, ride until, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 in the evening, depending on, how quick you were and the distances that were being covered. Cyclists had, heavy steel frames. They had 2 gears at that point. In order to switch gears, you turned you pulled the chain off, you turned the bike wheel around, fitted it back on, started riding again. So those are just conditions that exist within every tour at this point in time. Derailleurs, which are used to, change gears, are not included until the 1930s, or are not allowed until the 1930s. Cyclists have to repair their own bikes. They can only use one frame. All these things that change the fundamental nature of the race itself. And so on top of all those conditions that really make the race something, it's not just a matter of eking out a few seconds by, brute athleticism, but rather strategy and mechanical knowledge and pacing oneself and all these other things that just are less core to what the tour is these days. And then on top of that, you're facing road conditions that are causing constant tire flats, at the very least, broken frames, broken forks, a tire shortage, food shortages, sometimes, simply not having hotels, cyclists having to be put up in army barracks instead. Ultimately, leading up to the last few stages of the race, there are 15 in all over just under 30 days. So every other day is as a stage. The remaining cyclists reach the Western Front. They ride from Strasbourg to Metz and then Metz to Dunkirk. So really riding through the Western Front, where all the conditions they had faced to that point just become even more severe and even more difficult and really strain them to a breaking point. But, these are cyclists who, for better or worse, oftentimes worse, but had faced these conditions. They were in uniform up to a few weeks or days before the race started, just as a function of general mobilization. And so, to some degree, they were, they knew what they were in for. It was, of course, significantly worse than that because, you simply can't train or at least not to the same degree if you're in uniform, but they knew what was up ahead. And it just creates this incredible scene. I still, in the course of writing the book, I could understand the equation in my mind, the A, the B, the C, and the fact that they added together to create these conditions. But it was hard sometimes to really fundamentally understand the experience of what that must have been like to just, after, almost a month of riding every other day, to just face this landscape that you had encountered only months before, but under drastically different conditions, and then just powering through that almost like an automaton because you're so tired at that point.
That makes sense. I saw in the description that there were 67 cyclists who began, but only 11 finished, which it's hard to imagine the modern Tour de France having that dropout rate, but they're not working under the conditions that you just described. Lately in endurance sports, there's been an arms race to produce an event that's more and more over the top. So you'll have ultra marathons or 5 of them in a day. You'll have the Tough Mudder race where people have to run through the worst terrain possible. You'll have zombie races where they have extras that pretend to be zombies that chase you. So at some point I could see a person trying to recreate the 1919 Tour de France with the same sort of bikes and other things. Is it almost sounds like a gimmick with how hard it is, but it's not a gimmick. It's what people are dealing with in 1919. And Some of them you mentioned are either coming directly off active duty or still on active duty. What motivates these original 67 cyclists to enter the race?
Yeah, so it's a combination of factors. I mean, to some degree, it's on a very deep level, I think it's unknowable, but I think it is partially a function of the nature of the cycling community at that point, as well as, so back then, the Tour, which still has kind of some roots today, but is less formalized, was a combination of amateur and professional cyclists. You know, you could just, after registering, show up on the first day of the Tour without a team backing you, without a team paying for a salary, and ride alongside the professionals. And there was a separate class of individual cyclist who was, you know, equal in many regards on the day-to-day race course. And so the Tour took on this air, even before 1919, of a populist event, a national event, in a way that the more modern ultra sporting events simply don't. It was one where there was pride in having the Tour pass through one's town, of being able to give a few francs to the cyclists who rode through first. This kind of sense of community on a national level that in many ways didn't exist before the Tour, at least not in a kind of concrete manifestation as it does once the Tour begins and once the cyclists ride through these towns. And I think that is an important element of why the cyclists that did wind up making it through decided to race in the first place and, you know, carried through, is that there is this sense of a community and a national strength and resolve that manifests in this, and in some ways in the modern Tour too, but I think the particularities of the old Tour only heighten that. And so to some individual very deep degree, it seems insane to me that, you know, weeks or days after leaving uniform, now granted, some of them got leave as simply to compete in the race. So that's a slightly different case in terms of motivation. But I do think it ultimately, at least partly, is a function of how other people saw these cyclists, giving them an opportunity to race in this event, to show that this event can still occur, and then a desire to really take part in this event as something national and one of endurance. And you know, it on a simple practical level, it was a huge event. You know, it has large enough sums that it obviously make it worthwhile, although in the 1919 race, salaries and prizes were fixed to a greater degree as a function of, you know, simple cost cutting at the end of the war. So I think there are some very deep motivations that at least partly accounted for the fact of these cyclists deciding to compete and being allowed to compete. But on some really deep level, it's of course impossible to know, and it's a real deep drive. I at least know for, you know, Henri de Grange, the editor and the administrator of the Tour, that, you know, there is this kind of sense of glory that is bound up in the Tour de France that is not totally unique, but is very prominent among this community at that time.
A newspaper man putting on the show would mean that there'd, I'm sure, be a media angle to this and it becoming a press sensation. What was the public's engagement with the Tour de France like? My thought, and tell me if this analogy is correct or not, in the last 20 years with reality TV shows, whether it's Survivor or The Amazing Race or The Apprentice, Alone, what have you, where you latch on to somebody that you're rooting for, and as the contest goes on, different people are eliminated. And is it like that, or am I off there? Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Yeah, it is. I suppose it's not so dissimilar. The newspaper that Henri was the editor of, Lotto, had strict control over the media rights of the race for during these years, would continue for another 10 or so years, I believe. So apart from a monthly magazine and simple reports that were wired to other newspapers, really tried to drive subscriptions to their newspaper through intense coverage of the race every day, up leading up to it, during it, of course, and after the fact. And, you know, as a simple function of the fact that, you know, at its core, cycling, you can only talk about cycling in so many ways. Cyclists are pedaling on a bike. They're, you know, performing a limited set of actions. And so, yes, there are great distances covered and there are changing landscapes and all these other fascinating elements of the race, which only become more important if you're really dedicating pages and pages of a newspaper every day to a month-long race. And so these cyclists do become characters. It's perhaps a bit of a spoiler, but you know, a leading cyclist through a late portion of the race winds up falling as a function of the consequences of the road conditions. And despite the fact that he is no longer in first, maintains this place in the minds of the French people and in the newspaper, which would otherwise be pretty quick to, you know, revel in the fact of a new tour leader because of this kind of this tragic story and this sense of endurance that exists within his story in the 1919 race and as well as his longer cycling career. And I think that that perfectly goes to show that, yes, this is an event about intense athletes in a way, although very different than the athletes we consider these days, since, you know, someone's ability to repair a bike might be the difference between first and second place, just as much as how fast one can cycle. But also this sense of the tour cyclist being not this athlete, this unapproachable athlete, but someone who, you know, if you really wanted to, you could hop on that bike and join the tour cyclist next year. And, you know, maybe you'd get as far or maybe you wouldn't, but the fact of the matter is that you could compete, you could ride through those towns just like anyone else. And the, it was a much more populist form of an athlete than, and a populist event in terms of who did well and who, and, you know, this, these were about big differences based on accidents and strategy rather than eking out a few seconds because you're simply just a better athlete by a little margin than the second place cyclist.
What were some of the biggest challenges that cyclists faced? Because they're going up alpine roads, they're on very rickety bikes, they're in incredibly difficult terrain. What were some of the biggest challenges and captivating moments of the Tour de France?
Yeah, so there are the simple physical challenges that exist on a 5,500 kilometer bike race, which go beyond, you know, anything kind of imagining, particularly when you view it in concert with the limitations, the mechanical limitations of bikes at this point. So, you know, simple endurance is one level. There are stories of cyclists getting, you know, I don't know if you technically call it trench foot when you're not in the trenches, but trench foot after, you know, days of riding in, you know, an absolute downpour in, you know, tight leather shoes, various sorts of ailments that just come from, you know, straining yourself day after day. Then there are the ones that one encounters as a function of the roads themselves, whether that's roads that are damaged, falling into, you know, potholes. I don't have any instances of cyclists literally falling into craters, but, you know, they were riding on roads where craters would have been and, you know, just severe damage. So, you know, gashes, you know, tire flats, broken frames, all of these things existed and confronted the cyclists day after day from the first stage, really. I mean, it becomes most extreme and kind of scenic in its own dark way towards the end of the tour, but they ride through portions of the Somme on the first day between Paris and Le Havre, encounter some milder portions on the northwestern coast, though very scenic, go down to the Pyrenees, where roads are never particularly great at that time, just because they're not particularly well used or frequently used, riding up the eastern border And so they are facing circumstances related to unable to train, as well as even those who have had an ability to train, just simple functions of luck and strain that no one can avoid. And then there is this desire to have the tour be as it was before, to not give up anything as a function of the fact of it occurring just at the end of World War One, and instead doing everything they can to make a tour that is as intense and as complete as it was before the war, which just means that all of those conditions related to the war exert themselves on these cyclists day after day. And for many of them, you know, it causes them to reach their breaking point.
Of the many who drop out, 56, if my on-the-fly simple arithmetic is good, 67 join, only 11 finish. Is, I would imagine, just general fatigue set in? Are there any catastrophic events that wipe people out due to injury or something else that takes them out of the contest?
Yes. As I mentioned a tiny bit earlier, one of the rules of the race was cyclists only had one bike frame to use from the start to the end. They themselves were responsible for fixing that frame. And that means that if you as a cyclist aren't able to fix that broken fork or that broken, you know, pedal or whatnot, you're out. I mean, there's nothing for you to do. And so there are stories, you know, throughout that of cyclists who just, you know, encounter circumstances that simply prevent them from continuing, in addition to all the health ones that exists. And so, you know, I think the most catastrophic one occurs when the leader to that point, Eugene Christophe, has a broken fork towards the end of the race, and he is forced to walk his bike frame in a few kilometers to the next small town, who fortunately has a blacksmithing shop, and repairs the bike frame. He was a mechanic during the war, you know, was on a bicycle, not racing a lot of the time, but going back and forth from the front. And so had the ability to make this repair, but it still took him an hour. You know, it's a function of shaping the fork back to its original shape, welding it together, quenching it, putting it back onto the frame. And he persists through that and winds up, you know, finishing the race. But there are plenty of others throughout the earlier stages who simply have enough or simply don't have that knowledge that Eugene did to make those repairs. And then, you know, when facing severe health issues, you know, the things I can think of off the top of my head are, you know, trench foot, hemorrhoids, various things that just come after day of this sort of strain. There's only so much one can do. You can either decide to power through it or decide that you've hit a breaking point. And they had trainers and they had a variety of drugs that they used in order to get through another day. But at some point, no matter how much you might want it, the various cyclists just hit a point where they had had enough.
Right. I mean, it's amazing to hear that, because when you think of the Tour de France today, it's totally different. A cyclist, depending on how resourced they are, will have entire support teams, people behind them. If they're part of a team, sometimes another person will take lead. So you get the goose flying V effect where there's a windbreak. I'm sure you have a dedicated nutritionist, hyperbaric chamber for oxygen, and then getting into the netherworld of illegal activities. I don't know, Russian produced stem cells that you're injected with after every leg. Who knows what's going on? But at this time period, I don't know what cyclists would have at post-World War One. They have a cocktail of morphine to deaden the pain, some cocaine to raise them up, and for food, I don't know, does some Frenchman hand them a little loaf and some cheese that they munch on? Or are they essentially by themselves as they're going through this race, or do they have any sort of support team?
They have a little bit of a support team. Teams did exist at this point, but they were unable to offer anything material to the cyclists. The very first rule when the tour is announced on November 20th, 1918, just 9 days after the signing of armistice, which just goes to show you how excited or impatient Henri was to start this race. The very first rule is, you know, another cyclist cannot offer any support to another cyclist. The first penalty will be 30 minutes, then 2 hours, then being barred from the race. And so the teams did exist, but they were not allowed to. For instance, you know, having an individual who was not necessarily there in order to win the race, but to make it easier for the other cyclists who might wind up being able to sprint at the end. They offered a trainer who did what he could, but you know, the levels of support for that sort of, for those sorts of injuries and whatnot are limited. You know, doping did not have the same negative valence that it does these days. It was not the most frequently common. It was not something that was openly described in Lotto's coverage, but we know based on recollections of the cyclists that, you know, yes, cocaine, strychnine, morphine, at the end of the day, a decent bit of booze for most of the cyclists came into play to just deaden the pain, get quickly to sleep, have one day of rest before beginning it again. Very little in the way of nutritional science. It was mostly a function of what could you find on the road. So yeah, all of these circumstances, of course, nowadays we think of, and it's amazing that they were able to continue, or, you know, that some severe health consequence didn't befall them in the course of the race, which of course might have happened. It was not explicitly described as such as anywhere that I could find, at least in the 1919 race, but it's of course possible. But it just goes to show you that this sort of athlete was a wildly different one than what we kind of consider athletes these days to be, which are kind of almost superheroes. Like it's, you know, all of that support winds up creating or helping form an individual who, you know, if you were to just go out and do it, could not accomplish the same thing. Whereas for these cyclists, yes, they were paid a salary, which helped them spend more time on the bikes. But apart from that, you know, we're kind of average people for the most part. You know, most of them had jobs when the cycling season was not ongoing. And so, you know, getting through it was much more of a brute strength sort of thing than some perfectly cultivated training and endurance regimen.
At the end of the race, something you describe in your book is just this euphoria where there are people lining the route, they're waving flags or shouting encouragement at the cyclists. I would imagine some of this is in any Tour de France, but was there something special about this particular race because it came on the heels of World War One? Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
I think it was. It's the recollections within Lotto have a natural bias to play up the event as much as possible. Obviously, there were circumstances that made it a perfectly equivalent race, whether that's the number of people in the crowds or the number of cyclists, of course, or the exact route of the tour, a little bit different. Most of those conditions wound up making it more intense, but this was a fundamentally different race. And the Lotto shapes and is shaped, and the tour is shaped and shapes those perceptions. I think that the perfect example of it, or the most concrete and direct example of it, is the role of Eugene Christophe after the end of the race. He is the cyclist who was in the lead, wound up suffering that tragic accident, still continues, places well, but does not win the race. And in the weeks following, there is coverage after coverage of Eugene. There are prizes. So as I mentioned, individuals, small groups are perfectly able to send in small prizes, either to their preferred cyclist or the cyclist who, you know, rode through their town first, or whatever conditions they set out. That Lotto did not place any conditions upon individuals who wanted to give prizes. And in the weeks following the race, you see just, I think it winds up being like 11 or 15,000 francs pour into Eugene, many multiples of the eventual winner of the 1919 Tour of Belgium by the name of Fermin Lambeau. And Lotto describes Eugene as kind of the moral winner of the race, if not the actual winner. And You know, some of this might have existed in any year. There is work on an academic level that I looked into and which I couldn't adequately summarize here, just in terms of the differences that existed in Lotto's coverage between foreign and French-born winners and cyclists. And so some of that, you know, is at play and could be at play in any year. And some of it, you know, it's hard to separate Lotto shaping people's perceptions versus people shaping what Lotto wanted to cover or thought they should cover. But this just absolute outpouring in the race for this cyclist who I need to double check. I believe he winds up coming in third behind another French cyclist, I believe. And, you know, the fact that he is celebrated among above all the others, I think gestures to kind of what Lotto and Henri, on kind of a philosophical level, if they, you know, if you could separate out the personal interest and business interests, wanted in this 1919 tour, which was the sense of rebuilding, the sense of moral strength and continuity in the face of a war's end when so many other questions are just starting to be thought of. And I think that moment kind of describes how people were viewing this race, at least those who, you know, were really most philosophically or intellectually interested in the race at that point, as opposed to a simpler sense of relief or a distraction for a month before getting on with their lives.
Well, to tie the story in together, there's a lot of relevance to today because we're emerging from a pandemic and trying to move forward. And back then, I could see people joyous that the Tour de France is happening because it shows that the war hasn't taken away everything. And it's possible to pick up some of the pieces before the war and move on. Now, we know in hindsight, and I'm sure people knew in a gut level back then, that you couldn't pick up exactly where you left off. Historically, World War I is absolutely a watershed moment. Historians talk about the long 19th century after the French Revolution until World War I as a period. And then a completely different epoch happens afterwards. The Belle Epoque before World War I is one breaking point, and then the Roaring Twenties afterwards. So much changes. So things are fundamentally altered. It can't pick up exactly the way it was before. At the same time, there is an urging that these institutions, these traditions, these practices, they're not permanently dead. They're not permanently killed. The war hasn't defined us, is what some people, I imagine, are trying to claim and strike out with at this time period. Is there anything that you see that could have some relevance to today as we have undergone a year that had incredible shift? We don't even know how it's going to change our society, our institutions, but many people are talking about how it has, but many want to continue and move forward. So what do you see from this story of the 1919 Tour de France and any relevance to today in 2021?
Yeah, so I think it's unfortunately perhaps not. I mean, this is in many ways kind of, it is inherently the individual stories at least are kind of inspiring in someone, you know, deciding to continue this race despite suffering, you know, a tragic accident and things like that. And but I also had a larger desire to tell this story of rebuilding, which exists in kind of these interludes throughout the book of individuals who belong to various cultural or social groups that were more directly confronting issues of rebuilding. And end the book with this description of how Henri describes the race as, which, you know, this horrible event, which of course can't happen again. And my feeling towards its relevance is that, you know, we are so quick to desire this moving past, that we wind up allowing ourselves and allowing others who have an interest in causing us to forget much quicker than is beneficial. I think moving onward is, to a certain degree, of course, necessary and important, while at the same time recognizing the faults and limitations of doing so. And Henri is someone who has a strong anti-German sentiment, well beyond what, at least to modern day sensibilities, seems, of course, perhaps that's wrong, but really, you know, going into the pages of Lotto, just demanding the destruction of Germans, which of course extends to, you know, writing editorials about the Treaty of Versailles and things like that. And, you know, perhaps an even desire that it should have gone further and things like that. And what I wanted to gesture to in this was that the surrounding conditions wound up creating the circumstances, of course, for forgetting and allowing this other war to happen. They were so quick to say, you know, the war to end all wars, that the as conditions changed, the memory of the war, of course, existed in some ways, but they were so quick to move past it that I think the lessons weren't fully ingrained. And, you know, it's not a bright lesson or outlook. If anything, it's kind of a warning or something. I mean, I did not write this with a strong polemical sense in me, but, you know, I think just naturally as humans, we're very quick to move on and quick to desire that forgetting and have a hard time or a lack of a desire to take those hard lessons and really make something better with them. And so for all the circumstances that arise as a function of World War One, you know, they're gotten much more difficultly by having to go through this second war. And I think some of those are represented in this 1919 tour for all its glory, I guess, and intensity and inspiring nature. And I think those two can exist at the same time, and we can recognize both of them existing at the same time. And, you know, it would just be my hope that in some small way, people, you know, become better at holding history and moving forward both in hand at the same time.
Well, stories like this that are far removed from our contemporary situation sometimes have the best lessons because we have enough distance, we can look at them critically and then hopefully apply that to our situation today. Well, for listeners who want to check it out in greater detail, the book is Sprinting Through No Man's Land, Endurance, Tragedy, and Rebirth in the 1919 Tour de France. Aidan, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, that is all for today's episode. As a first order of business, I need to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, and I'll explain what that is in a second. And they are Kristen Lee, Willie from New Jersey, Sumo 41, Sergeant Hooch, Wire Meets Wood Guitars at WMWGuitars.com, Bill Ivey, Tom from Ohio, Salvador Sanchez, Dane Carlson from Linwood, Washington, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael Piccinetti, Michael from New York, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Josh Reddick, Jake Harrington, Josh from BFW Post 2285, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. Now, if you'd like to support History Unplugged and help it grow, there are three easy ways to do so. First, subscribe to the show and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people discover the show. Second, join our Facebook group, and here you can discuss recent episodes with fellow listeners, mention what you'd like to see on the show in the future, and get way more out of the show, and just look for History Unplugged on Facebook. Third, become a member of the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were an elite reconnaissance and espionage detachment of the Continental Army established by George Washington, but it's also the membership group of History Unplugged, and here you can really dive in way deeper with the show. You can check it out by going to Patreon, patreon.com/unplugged. If you join at the Scout level, you get early access to new podcast episodes, and you get completely ad-free versions of the entire back catalog of more than 500 episodes. Plus, everything is neatly categorized, so if you want to listen to something about the Middle Ages and skip all the Civil War stuff or vice versa, you can easily find an old episode from 3 years ago that, if you're just looking on Apple Podcasts, would be buried in the feed. If you join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the same stuff, but access to a growing catalog of now more than 60 premium episodes that come out bi-weekly, including a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, a series on French Foreign Legion fighters in World War I, one on Teddy Roosevelt's years in the Dakota Badlands, and a series on Nazi attempts to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Lastly, if you join the Spymaster level, you get all the same stuff as level 1 and 2, but you also get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You can choose a historical topic on absolutely anything, and I'll base an hour-long episode on it. Plus, you get a 3-pack of hardcover books. So again, check it all out by going to patreon.com/unplug. Well, that's all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.